again and welcome to another episode of Voices from SA. My name is Nicholas Claude. I hope all is well with you wherever you are. Today's episode is a little trip outside a journey outside my comfort zone. My guest this week is the Reverend Diane Willman. She's a Catholic priest and also a deputy director at the National Prosecuting Authority, where she has worked for the last 20 years. I say out of my comfort zone because I'm neither religious, I mean, I don't believe in God, or dare I say it, particularly spiritual. You know, the questions or the issues that I raised were sort of really just for my own curiosity, and I hope you can bear with that. I am intrigued, I suppose, by the role of the church or organized religion in relation to the individual and to society as a whole. The idea that the church can, or a religion can offer some sort of personal comfort, solace, and at the same time that an organized religion can become or is a force of, dare I say it, oppression, but certainly conservatism in many societies. So it was a chat about faith, about her calling to the priesthood, the work within her community, wanting to create what she calls a better church that accepts a changing world. We also obviously do touch a little bit on her work at the NPA and the asset forfeiture unit where she is a senior manager. So please now enjoy my chat with Diane. Diane, good afternoon and thank you for your time.
Hi, Nicholas.
Good to meet you. You know, I think the second person that John Clark has now pushed my way, if I can put it like that, with all respect. We had a great chat, and just an interesting take on his activism, and then it only sort of came out quite late in the discussion that he actually had a theology background.
Yes.
That you do have some kind of religious or relationship that is like you are his priest. Is that?
Well, I think he calls me that.
Yeah, that's how he refers.
Yes.
<you.
laughs>
The point is, you are a priest in the Catholic Church.
That's correct. Yes.
And could you just explain that to me, because I'm not even, I was just trying to do a little bit of research and it was unclear to me as to whether you are indeed like officially recognized as priests within the Catholic Church or what is the Catholic Church's
the
attitude towards women priests?
Well, maybe I need to just back up a bit and give the position, let's call it the legal position if you like. So in terms of canon law, which is the law of the church, one of the canons, 1024, says that only a baptized male can receive the sacred orders validly. So obviously it's only men who can do that. So a woman who's doing that is obviously in breach of that canon. So it is unlawful. Some use the word illicit. So it's not accepted, it's not condoned officially, because it is breaking a law.
A church law,
correct. That's a good distinction to make. the official position is that women are not permitted, and those who do attempt ordination, and they say attempt because they can't say ordination, because it means that they are accepting that it is a valid ordination. But those who are attempt ordination or who are ordain face excommunication, and it's automatic excommunication. So there is a penalty for breaking this law. So no, we're not officially recognized. We are still Catholic. Excommunication doesn't mean that you're suddenly not Catholic, that suddenly your baptism is reversed in some way. We just, for example, can't participate officially in the sacraments of the church and undertake ministerial-type functions formally in the church. So, yeah.
So what? Well, there's two things that come out of that. I mean, the first is why you would choose to do that, because I think there may be other Christian churches that would. Well, I know it's a struggle for women priests generally in all churches, but I know, for example, the Anglican Church or yes. Church of England seems to be more accepting of, or at least have not gone to the lengths that the Catholic Church has gone to excommunicate etc. So that's the one thing is why you would even choose to take that path. And the second thing is then, what is your role if you cannot? What is your what do you see as your purpose then? So, I mean, that's two quite big things. But maybe just like why you chose this
course of action.
Almost like, is it a protest? Is it a confrontation? Are you trying to do something within the church?
I think primarily you've got to look at it from it being a call. And the phenomenon of call in especially the Catholic Church is very big. One is called to priesthood, one is called to be a religious sister, one is called to the single life, to religious life, and so on. And so this falls within that phenomenon of call. I have felt called by God to be a priest and for some time. And I am born and bred a Catholic. I'm one of those very Catholic type people, very much part of parish life, have done all the Catholic things, even went to Catholic school, and the desire to serve and to be priest grew from childhood. So it's not a new thing, it's not a whim that I suddenly have. And so the call is not away from the Catholic Church, it is part of who I am, the value, the riches, the depth, the tradition of the Catholic Church is where I feel most at home, and that speak most deeply to me in my relationship with God. So why would I stay? Well, effectively, the church is my home. It's my family, in a sense, and where there is a struggle in the family, one stays within and tries to work things out. We see our role as one of being acting in prophetic obedience to our conscience. So it's living the change that you wish to see in the future. So it may not be permitted legally in terms of church law right now, but by living it now, we're hoping that change will be started. At the very least, that this idea gets talked about and perhaps starts the awareness and seeing a woman in a Catholic priest role will also help break open that consciousness and hopefully stimulate the momentum towards change.
Because, I mean, at the same time, okay, that sounds like you're aware of the struggle that you've entered into and it has some purpose. But at the same time, I mean, do you see that then hopefully being a catalyst for changing the church in terms of its attitude towards abortion or gay rights? Because, I mean, the Catholic Church is not the only conservative religion on the planet, but, I mean, it does have a kind of, I think, a particular reputation.
Yeah.
And so do you see that then as part of that,
It could speak to It could speak to other issues as well. And why I say that is we're not primarily about, well, let's just put in a female priest. Let's just substitute bodies, so to speak. We're about a new model of church. So it's, for example, a different setup in terms of priesthood. It's non-hierarchical, for example. We do perhaps a celebration of the sacraments in a little bit of a different way that's more inclusive. So, for example, we welcome Catholics and Protestants in our communion, in our Eucharistic services. And so that's one way, for example, that we are, in a sense, breaking new ground. We're not having requirements around whether you're Catholic or not, whether you're divorced or not, as to whether you can receive the Eucharist or not. Gay and straight people are most welcome to be part of our communities, and fully so, and to even be priests as well. So, yes, in a way, indirectly, these other kinds of needs, these other areas for reform, are hopefully also going to be opened up.
Well, you say we.
So the women's ordination movement is part of a broader international movement known as RCWP, which stands for Roman Catholic Woman Priests.
Yes.
It's formed and started officially in the US, although...
When was that?
In about 2002.
Whoa, okay.
Yeah, the first priests were ordained actually in Europe first, on the Danube, and then from there the organization has spread, the movement has spread, mainly growing in America. We have about 300 odd priests now worldwide. And in South Africa, there are three priests and then one bishop.
Oh, wow, a bishop even.
Yes.
It's just like, it's quite, to get my head around it, you know. So that's within that RCWP, they make the appointments, not the Vatican.
No, correct, yeah. Because it's not officially recognized by the church. We say our ordinations are valid because it's done by a bishop who, in apostolic succession, that's quite an important aspect of an ordination being valid. And so, yes, we say our ordinations are valid. We are still Catholic, and we... wait for the future change, which we will be embraced by the official church. Although that comes with some provisos, because it's not, as I've said, about just swapping bodies. It's about bringing about...
It's a fundamental sort of philosophical change of the church.
It's a lot of change. There's a lot that needs to change to embrace this new model of church that we're trying to live.
So it's a kind of... use the word feminist... movement within the Catholic Church, or a protest movement, or is it just? I mean, you obviously have an incredible bond with the Church and respect for the traditions of the Church, and I'm just wondering if this was seen as perhaps an effort to save the Church from itself in a way.
Yeah, I would use that. If you like the word saving as opposed to protest action, we really are not conflictual in nature. Perhaps more speaking for myself, but I know that this is a general approach, is that we're getting on to practice the better. Instead of engaging in debate and any kind of hostility and confrontation, we are getting along and practicing what we believe is the better version of the Catholic faith, if you like. And then when you say the word feminist, well, we must be careful of labels, because I think they come with a lot of connotations that may be negative for some and maybe positive for others. But yes, if it's a woman's movement, men are obviously part of that as well. It's not just a female-only thing. And yes, it would form within the broad range of liberation theology and more feminist theology as well. So, yeah, I don't know if that answers your two comments there.
No, when I say saving the church from itself, I'm thinking more of trying to move the church to recognize the changes that have happened in our societies.
Yeah.
Not all societies, of course, but, I mean, we see the legalization of gay marriage. Again, I come back to that. Abortion rights. the role of women in society at a sort of very fundamental level has changed over the last, certainly over the last 50 years, 30 years, certainly post-war in Europe.
Yes.
So was that, I mean, that's obviously kind of where you are coming from then.
Yeah, and the church has changed. There have been, if you take a very broad view of history and as things have been evolving, the church has evolved. It's just, it changes very slowly. Mm. And I think that's wise to ensure that it's taken the whole church with it. And also that it's not just a fad, for example, but it is a genuine movement of the spirit. And so, for example, with the feminist movements from the 70s onwards, there's been increasing involvement of women in the church. Even now, Pope Francis, for example, is appointing women in very significant positions. Mm-hmm. We're not at the stage of women priests at the moment, so that is a change that hopefully will still come. But it's not an entirely shut subject anyway.
Even at that sort of in the Vatican circles?
Correct. Okay. We have, for example, that commission to study women deacons that was set up, I think, in 2016 by Pope Francis. So the conversations are happening, and he himself is very open to having that kind of dialogue and research being undertaken.
Yeah, he seems to be quite an interesting character, Francis. I mean, okay, he calls himself, he's a... he seems to profess sort of a very humble kind of theology, if I can call it that, Francis of Assisi. So, again, I suppose showing some awareness for some of the issues.
Yes.
But again, I suppose... A bit like Cyril Ramaphosa against the ANC, dare I say. I mean, it's like just hitting certain walls along the way.
It's a mammoth task, a difficult, tricky path to tread,
I suppose.
And it's an institution as well. So like with most institutions, they are big and they're large and they're difficult to change very easily. And there's all sorts of parts that you have to engage with and consult with. And being a church, you don't want to lose anyone along the way, kind of.
I just want to talk a bit generally about, and again, just, you know, in preparation for this discussion, I mean, I'm not I don't come from a religious home. I come from a home, I think, that exposed us to all religions, certainly. Okay. I mean, we went to a Jewish primary school, my siblings. You know, my parents took us to the fire walking ceremony in Cato Manor. All those years ago when we were kids. So I think they kind of left it to us in a way. But it's not something that I've ever felt sort of any bond with. And I'm trying to sort of think about how people do join a church.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have an incredible faith in or belief in God as the creator of all things. I can't get my head around that. At the same time, I like to think of myself as maybe not a spiritual person, but at least somebody with a moral compass or who can sort of would like to do good. I'm just wondering how you sort of reconcile those sort of people within the church and without the church or out of the church. Do you accept all people? How do you? And then if so, then why do you need the church in the first place?
Mm. Sure. These are big questions all in one.
They're just kind of coming out of my head, quite honestly. I'm just sort of...
Well, okay, so maybe just a few comments in no particular order. So why church? Church is useful in the sense of organized religion. It has a good function to play in the sense of provide structures and sustainability and the ability to transmit the faith and the traditions on an ongoing and long-term process. So from that point of view, the structure or the institutional dimension is very useful, and helps grow an individual, almost if you like, in the first stages. It's the container. It's the starting blocks, and then there is the role of spirituality, which is the, let's say, the more dynamic element of the church. It almost, I think, keeps it alive. It's the work of the spirit. And that somehow between the institution and the spirit, that there's this hopefully a dynamic relationship that will continue to keep the church not just as a stagnant relic, but actually a growing organic creature, if you like, and also pilgrimaging in a sense. Our church is to be a pilgrim church. It's to keep moving, but deeply listening to the spirit, but obviously also taking steps to be able to sustain itself. In terms of I think your one point about those who are in and those who are out, I'm not too sure if I followed you correctly, but in terms of our movement and where we are, we embrace all the excluded. So currently in the church, there are those who may not receive communion. For example, as I've mentioned, if you're divorced, you also are not permitted to certainly if you're gay, to get married in the church. So we're there. We're ministering, let's call it, we're ministering on the margins. It's those who perhaps the church, the formal organized religion, isn't reaching. And that is where we find ourselves at least extending the church's reach. And I use that word church in a broad form. We also hold the view that there are some significant commonalities between our different religions. And instead of being at war and in conflict with one another, well, let's draw on the gifts that we can bring to the table.
I'm interested in the idea of the church and its role towards the individual and the church as an institution that sometimes can offer sort of individual solace, but as an institution can be quite a conservative and, dare I say, oppressive institution. And I'm just, that I think is kind of where I have the issue. I tell the story of the time I was in Buenos Aires and I went to the oldest established, I believe it's the oldest established, certainly Catholic chapel or church, right, in Argentina, perhaps, right, I think in Latin America. And I just went there just to sort of more as an historical exercise, I suppose. But I sat in that space. It was a kind of crypt, quite, as I remember it, quite dark. I went and I went onto Google and it seemed very bright and light. Yes. So I don't know if my memory is kind of confused or even if I was in the right place. It just had the feeling of a very old sort of candle-lit space.
And I'm sure there was a relic or two that you could go and...
Certainly. and you know, people lighting their candles. Yes. But I saw this whole sort of cross-section, I suppose, of what I would believe to be or understand to be Buenos Aires and... society. There was the old widow in her black shawl. There was a businessman with his briefcase. There was a young student with long hair, and they were all there sort of getting some comfort out of that space. And I have to say that I do, whether it's a mosque or a temple or a church, I do appreciate the solace and I suppose maybe spiritual comfort that just the space alone gives.
Well, we're spiritual, and our souls, our spirits respond to a contemplative side of life, a time of silence, a time of quiet, that you can actually refuel, or in spiritual terms, encounter God, and that is very refreshing and nourishing for our souls. So yes, I'm not surprised that and I'm glad that you found some solace in the church. It's not always the case for some people, but
But I think I'm just sort of trying to juxtapose that sort of that individual sort of peace that comes from the church, and at the same time, I still see churches, I have to say, as not forces of progress. And that's where I think I have difficulty in even, you know, somebody like yourself, I suppose, in a way, submitting themselves to that sort of institution, even though you are, as you say, part of a movement that is a movement for change and progress.
I think perhaps just some comments on that. Yes, if the institution is not alive, is not listening deeply, is not responsive to the spirit, is not reading the signs of the times, it can be oppressive, to use your word. It can be deeply wounding, actually. I would use that word. We know of the abuse that's going on, but also just wounding in our souls, where we don't find the love and the care and the encounter with God that we should be experiencing, being facilitated by the church. So, yes, it can be that when it's not done right or done well. But this is also the role of the individual to perhaps take responsibility and to then, well, what about my relationship with God? Do I depend on the church? Do I depend on the priest giving me the sacraments and that's all I need to grow my faith? Or am I going to take responsibility and embark on a spiritual journey where it comes from where the locus, if you like, of authority is now within my encounter, exactly in my encounter with God, or am I externalizing it and outsourcing it to the church? And so we've got this interesting relationship that forms between the individual and the institution. And
the faith, I suppose.
Yes, yes. And the extreme of one or the other is a problem. It's the balance we're trying to find here.
Because the other term I think that I come across that sometimes I struggle with is this, you know, the will of God, or it's God's will.
Yes.
Whatever happens. Or even, you know, a guy who's just won a world championship or won a gold medal in something, and he says, you know, I'd like to thank God. It seems to... I sometimes, you know, you whoever you are, you, the man or woman who's done all the hard work, has done the hard work. I suppose maybe they found comfort and support in their faith. That's one thing. But I don't know, sometimes if there's a terrible tragedy or somebody's child gets killed and it's God's will, that's... Is that just a way of just... It almost seems to me a way of just checking out of the reality or the world.
It can, and it can also be quite painful to say, well, you know, it's God's will that you suffer. I think we've got to be very careful around what we think is God's will. You know, I think the whole notion of discernment, and I'm particularly referring to, for example, an Ignatian principle here of discernment, where there is deep listening to the movements of the spirit on a long-term basis at an intense level to your life. And so you become aware of what God may be doing or in your life or saying to you, as opposed to becoming a very glib statement of, well, it's God's will that you suffered, or it's God's will that happened. There is simply an area of life that, because we are human beings, because we're part of a natural order of things, we're going to be impacted. We are all interconnected in some way, so there are going to be global tragedies. And it's almost the blessing and the curse of being a human being. So to say that is God's will, I think it's a very narrow focus, and it almost it creates God into an image that is not life-giving. It's a rather harsh God, whereas we should really be looking for this God of love that is the true image of God.
What is your experience with your parishioners, if I may call that? What are people in your experience looking for from the church and from your church in particular, would you say?
I think there's a variety.
I mean, everyone's different, of course. But yes. I'm just thinking, particularly in the sort of context of this, the world that we live in today, yeah. which does seem to be. I don't know. Maybe the world has always been chaotic, and some would say that it's, the world's never been more peaceful. And yes. You know, in the history of global conflict and global chaos, that yes. we are living actually in quite peaceful times. But it does seem to be that you know, okay, there's no war, but there's imminent climate disaster, etc., etc. So there's always seemed to be something hanging over us. But I mean, do you get a sense of where people are in your parish?
Yeah, I think. Okay, well, we don't use the word parish, but it's a community. I'm deliberately pointing that out because I think that's also what we're looking for. We're looking for community. We're looking at places of encounter with each other and with God that involves spirituality, which involves the traditions of the church, the depths and the riches, as I've mentioned earlier. And so our community is drawing from various quarters. There are mostly Catholics who are part of this community, and not to say that I speak for them, but things like frustration with the church and the slowness of change, perhaps that you've expressed, and the perhaps the lack of individual attention or something like that has raised questions in themselves and spurn them on to join a community like this and to live a different model, a different way that feels more faithful to the gospel values, for example. And then, of course, those also who come are those who are wounded by the church in one way or the other, excluded. There are divorced people who are present. And there are also Protestants, people who are not Catholic, who are part of the community. So we really are living an inclusive new model of church.
It's interesting when you say includes people that have been wounded by the church, that they still have. I mean, why wouldn't they just reject the church?
I think that's a complex subject. You know, you can be in a family, but you can't necessarily reject your family. There's inherent depths to it and at the DNA level, if you like. Mm. There's parts that are really wrong with it, but there are parts that are really right and really good as well.
I want to touch a little bit on, you know, we've spoken about spirituality, and you know, you mentioned the fact that I do find some comfort in religious spaces, or you know, the silence
yes.
for me is, I suppose, something. But I think where I go is into the bush. I go into nature to find that.
Good. The original place.
I hadn't thought about that. Yeah, but I'm not communing with a God. I'm maybe sort of communing with myself, I suppose. I mean, is that still a path to some kind of spiritual enlightenment, or do you still feel that I need people do need the guidance of an institution to find a path to? Because I mean, we're talking essentially about sort of people looking for meaning in life or to life, I think. Mm. I mean, I was reading the other day that, I forget where it was, in the Guardian newspaper perhaps, I mean, the crux question that philosophers even today are dealing with is like, who are we? And I suppose you would still accept that there are many paths to answering that question, even though you are from a particular sort of institutional way
or
of thinking.
Particular religious background, yeah.
So I'm just, again, it sort of comes back to how the church even exists, I suppose, and how it still can be relevant.
Mm.
I mean, are those sort of things that you grapple with yourself? Or are you sort of very so confident in your faith?
There's a lot of questions in that one comment. Maybe just to step back to what you started with, is communing with nature and taking some time out. I think that's valuable for every human being, whether you believe in God or not. We, like I've said, we're more than just simply physical beings. We're also spiritual. There's another dimension to us, and we need to tend to that part of ourselves. So communing with nature, having some time out, being on your own, that place of stillness and peace, of course that would speak to you because we're human beings and that's how we're created. So it's a very good thing that for example, what you're doing and what you've mentioned now. I would say that the church and organized religion perhaps, but I'm only going to speak on behalf of the Christian side, there is more that they can add to that experience potentially. And instead of reinventing the wheel or shutting our eyes to something that might be very rich and very helpful, keep the church there. And perhaps it's more of a both and a relationship as opposed to an either or. We've just got to be very careful around the institutional part of it. That is where we can cause good and we can cause harm with it. And that's what we've got to be very careful with.
I suppose that balance then would lead me on to the relationship between religion or the church in this context and science. And how you see those two worlds interacting, if they possibly can. I mean, you know, there are a lot of scientists out there who are vehemently anti-church, anti-religion overall. And there are, scientists who would call themselves Christian or religious. I suppose again it comes down to this quest for meaning. Science is also, I think, in many respects, a search for meaning. How do they meet?
Yeah, the notion,
and particularly in terms of like evolution, for the concept of evolution, for example.
The notion of science and religion should not be against one another. And it certainly isn't. We embrace science. And when I say we, the church, the Catholic Church, we have some very powerful religious writers on this issue, if we can call them religious writers, theologians. Just thinking of one now, for example, a religious sister. I think she's a Franciscan sister, who is also a physicist, as far as I can remember. I think her name is Ilia Delio, and she writes, quite a bit on this interaction between religion, faith, and science, the physical world, physics as well. So it really, once you start engaging at these depths, like she does, for example, and also the writings of a Jesuit priest known as Teilhard de Chardin, this is all about faith and the created world, faith and science, being able to be embraced together and not just, well, it's either one or the other.
Hmm. That's good to hear.
Yes. Very.
No, because, I mean, particularly I think you see the sort of rise of anti-scientific thinking in the world today, and it seems to be, particularly in the United States, very much this faith-based, very fundamentalist, I would say.
Yeah.
Not even Christianity,
if
I could put it that way. And I suppose that's, again, part of your fight then, in your movement.
When you say fight, sorry, I just...
Well, sorry. Yeah. Part of your... one of the things you're sort of wanting to move away from is that sort of fundamentalist type.
Correct.
Type of thinking.
And fundamentalism either side, it makes one rigid and closed and shuts down, as opposed to being open to diversity and of whatever kind. So yeah, we would like to say that we steer away from any kind of fundamentalism.
I think one of the things that struck me as well, or just one of the thoughts, you're talking about Catholics and Protestants in your community, which, I mean, is one of the longest sort of struggles within the church, certainly within the Christian, organized Christian church. And I mean, you still will, I suppose, meet Catholics or Protestants who could not abide by that idea.
Yes,
and
yes.
Of course, they are still fighting in various parts of, well, particularly in Northern Ireland. But it struck me that all religions, as many of the sort of organized, if I can call them that, and I'm thinking even of beyond monotheistic into the Hindu kind of churches, there's a lot of little subsects, aren't there? And so, like, is everyone praying to the same God in a different kind of way? I mean, is it all a path? It's all a path to understanding
into the great
world
mystery.
Through a God.
Yeah, into the great mystery. And we all have different names for God, for this mystery, for the divine. And there are different ways to encounter the divine and to develop a relationship with this mystery that we call God. I'm reminded now of some words that another writer and modern-day mystic, you would say, of Cynthia Bourgeau, who said that there is such commonality when we get to the mystical depths of our religions, and that we've got to hold that commonality, but at the same time we've got to hold the what she called the excruciating particularities as well. So we are different, but we're also at one, at the really mystical roots. We're seeking the divine, we're seeking the mystery, we're seeking a relationship, we're based on love. Love is the expression, the outflow of that relationship. And so those are just some examples of where there is this deep commonality, but we need to move past those institutional and doctrinal differences that divide as opposed to unite.
I want to just change course for a bit. some light relief. You also work for the NPA.
Ah, yes. Is that light relief?
Look, I know it's obvious it might be quite a sensitive topic, and I don't want to get into too much of that, but can you just tell me what it is you do at the NPA? Mm.
So, yeah, I'm a lawyer by profession. I'm an advocate, and I've been with the NPA for now 20 years
this year.
Yeah, 20 years.
Wow.
Started off as a prosecutor, and currently I'm a deputy director in the asset forfeiture unit.
Okay.
So that's where
I wasn't even aware that still existed.
The asset forfeiture unit. Yes, very much so.
Okay.
Yes. In fact, it's our 20 years this year. 20 years.
Was that Willy Hofmeyr?
Correct. He is now, yeah. He's
okay.
Back
right.
as our head.
Okay, he was in and then out and then back again.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's, I suppose, part of this whole rejuvenation, if I can put it that way, of the NPA.
Of the new, yeah, possibly.
I just wanted to get an just want you to explain, because I think sometimes people do get confused about particularly what the NPA, the purpose of the NPA is in terms of our legal system.
Right.
So the NPA is responsible for all prosecutions in the country?
That's correct, yes.
So that is the public prosecutor's office?
Yes, it's the organization through which prosecutions are instituted and conducted.
And so how does that work in terms of a crime being committed, the police find somebody and then they present the evidence to you and you say there's enough evidence now to go to trial? Is that as simple as it is?
Yeah, if you want a simple illustration of how it works, yes.
Okay.
And in the asset forfeiture side, we would take the proceeds from that crime or the instrumentalities of those crimes. So we're another dimension to fighting crime.
Yeah, I think it's a fascinating concept that you sort of seize the profits of crime.
We use the word proceeds. It includes
profits.
Profits is more of a limited notion.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
What is the difference?
Well, one is not just going after, for example, just the the net proceeds. One must look at the bigger picture of, for example, there's a benefit by being able to pay expenses towards buying, for example, drugs. So one just doesn't look at your profit. You're also looking at the benefit that you could actually buy that stock and so on. So mm-hmm. it's not just profit. It's much bigger than that.
Can I ask you how you ended up in the NPA?
Well, I think the overall question for Diane is she has a passion for justice, so which might be coming through the priesthood as well. That I really can't tolerate certain aspects. So my justice sense is met was what drove me into law, and in particular on the prosecution side.
You always felt that that's where you wanted to be.
Yes.
You didn't want to be a big shot corporate lawyer.
No.
Is that sort of your family background and your religious upbringing, or where did that sort of sense?
I don't actually know where it comes from. It feels like that I was born with a sense of justice and what's not right in the world, and also the concern where there is injustice and what can I do about it. So my question has always been, well, one can see injustice and look at it and that's very bad, but what can we do about it exactly? And I'm very much around action. It's not just simply seeing or diagnosing. It's, well, what can I bring to the situation? And so as a prosecutor, I am, for example, hopefully trying to contribute my little 2 cents to this movement to try and help the South African society and fight crime and rectify the imbalances and help victims of crime. My current functions are now focused mostly on training.
Okay.
So I train local and foreign prosecutors.
Oh, foreign?
Well, all over Africa.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes,
oh,
we
excellent.
Have quite a strong network in asset forfeiture, recovery.
Within SADC or within the AU?
Broader. It's part of an organization known as ARINZA. We're a asset recovery, part of an asset recovery network in Africa.
Okay.
So, yeah.
And when was that established?
10 years ago.
I'm not even aware.
No. It's well. Law enforcement people are aware of it. Let me say asset recovery practitioners. That's our network on the continent to be able to share information. And the main thing is to build capacity. And the AFU is the main deliverer of this capacity building,
particularly through training. Then.
Correct.
And so how many countries does that encompass now?
I don't know what the last count was, but I know there are at least about 12 countries at the moment.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you talk about training, but would it also include, like, secondment? Would people from different African countries work in your office and you would go and send people to other offices?
Yes, well, it's more the other way around. They come here.
Share best
We're the most established organization in asset recovery on the continent, in terms of the ARINZA countries. So we have quite a bit to share, and we are always willing and happy to share our knowledge and our experiences.
That's amazing.
So yes, we do have exchanges. We have placement programs.
That's given me quite a lift, I have to say.
It is a lift, and there's some good things happening. And
what is your sense then of this kind of cooperation when it comes to law enforcement, in particular in the region? I mean, is there political will?
There really is. In fact, we've just celebrated 10 years of ARINZA in Tanzania, and it was a remarkable celebration and. Well done to them, just honouring the work of that has been achieved through ARINZA. So if it's in the media, it's online, so you're welcome to also have a look.
Yeah, definitely.
But there really is a lot happening, which sadly doesn't get into the media.
A great pity, because I'm intrigued by sort of South Africa's role and on so many levels on the continent, and it seems we lost ground a little bit in some of the discussions I've had with people, particularly just at a diplomatic level within the AU and maybe even SADC, but more at that sort of multi national, continental level, if I can put it that way. So it's, and I suppose those do impact somehow also the progress that you're able to make. But that's good to hear.
Yes.
What is the future for? I mean, is Arinze now, is your hope to get as many or get all countries in the
I'm not too sure. Yeah, I don't think that's necessarily the intention of Arinze. But we are quite a well-functioning network. There are one or two other networks on the continent as well.
Law enforcement and prosecution.
I'm talking asset recovery.
Okay.
Solely, I'm not.
So it's quite, I mean, asset recovery is quite a then specialized.
Yes, very much so. And fairly recent as well. We're talking a couple of decades only. In some countries, it's even a matter of just being a 2 or 3 years old.
What are the sort of skills then that a good asset forfeiture department need?
Well, it's comprised of lawyers, so you would need proper training as a lawyer, and it's particularly civil in nature, so a good understanding of both civil and criminal law. And then, of course, there are other dimensions to our work. Enforcement, for example, investigators. Those would be our core disciplines. And so the link, for example, between my work as a lawyer and as my work, and in fact, I don't even want to call it work, my ministry,
your
my
calling.
Service, my calling as a priest, for me, I don't see as distinct at all.
Hmm.
In fact, they're one. they're about both about justice on some levels, but it's about actually living the change that you wish to see and doing something about injustice that exists. So the values are very much the same across both. And in fact, you know, one's faith is not just limited to Sunday morning masses. One lives one faith all the time.
Yeah.
And there should be that integration.
That's a commitment on a level that, I find kind of almost beyond understanding. But Diane, thanks so much for your time today.
Pleasure. Thank you.
I think there was certainly a lot for me there. And I appreciate that.
Thank you. And thank you for your time and the invitation.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that. As I say, I was a little, I didn't feel I had the kind of intellectual weapons to really get too deep into the discussion, but I hope that my curiosity came through and that you found it interesting. Intrigued how she sort of coupled her church work with her NPA work as essentially ways of fighting for justice in practical ways, and that she sees both as a calling in one way or another. Voices from SA is hosted on Audioboom. You may subscribe to Voices from SA via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Radio Public, Deezer, or indeed wherever you get your podcasts. Tell your colleagues, tell your friends, tell the world. Until next time, I'm Nicholas Claude. Cheers.